Hi, I'm Mike the Birdman Dodd, one of the hosts of ThisWeekInGeek.net, which you can find on ThisWeekInGeek.net.
No shit, Sherlock!
That makes no fucking sense.
Everyone has been destroyed because of this freak! I won't allow it!
These babies just saved this lame death party!
You're listening to This Week in Geek, otherwise known as Twig, your flagship of stupidity. I am one of your many hosts this week. I am Mike the Birdman Dodd, but I'm not alone as I trek down the path of stupidity and wonder. I'm joined with the man from Kitchener himself.
Alex, who's eating toast and trying not to show it.
I love what you're eating when we're recording. And we also have upstairs the man in the know, the man about town.
I'm not eating toast, but my name's Mr. Christopher.
Woo! So yes, my wife is in front of me doing inappropriate things. So yes, we are back here on Twig as we often are each and every week. We do thank you for your patronage and subscribing to us on iTunes or any podcatcher. And this week, as we most often do, we usually talk about what we've been doing, what has been absorbing our weeks such as it has been. And this week, I gotta say, I've been absorbed by something. In fact, I've actually been neglecting my Twig duties this week, and my wife has given me the finger because of it. So last week, I was on the PlayStation Store, and I was browsing, and I saw this game. And it's a game that I've heard Alex mention to me in passing a couple of times. And that game is Atlas Software's Persona 5. And I've heard people talk about this game and say, yeah, it's great, it's fantastic, game of the year, it's one of the best games I've ever played, blah, 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 blah. And I assumed it would just be another one of those things. Blah, 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 blah. So, but I've heard a lot of really cool things about the game's story. The thing that always stopped me from buying it is, it's a JRPG, I don't have 90,000 hours, nor do I have $70 to pay for it. But last week, something happened. It dropped to $20. I have $20, which can be exchanged for goods and services.
Ooh.
So, I decided, you know what? I'll take a chance. Why the hell not? What's the worst that could happen? Well, folks, the worst thing happened. I am currently in that game, thanks to some assist tools, which just pretty much, I'm just playing it for the story. I don't care about the actual gameplay, so flame me in the comments all you want. I just want to see what happens. I am close to 70 hours in that game. Everything maxed out. I'm pursuing relationships in that game. I'm trying to get the max confidant level with as many people as I can without screwing up my dating with this one girl that I'm dating in the game. And it has been a trip. I have not been this absorbed in an RPG since Mass Effect. Like, this literally is probably one of the best games I've ever played, where I'm considering doing a legit playthrough at some point next year. I'm just going to get through it now to see what the big deal is, and then next year I'll do a fresh playthrough, legitimately, and see what happens. Whoa. But goddamn you, Alex! 70 hours!
I put, like, 100 hours into Persona 4 Golden.
I
and
wake
that was
up
on the Vita. That's the reason I bought my Vita.
I had it on the Vita, but I never got past the first 3 hours. But I thought it was cool. But this sucked me right in. Like, I can't believe how much. Actually, you know what? I can tell you exactly how you sold this to me. You said, hey, Mike, you have a magical adventure. Okay, cool. And you have a kitty cat that turns into a car. And you sold me specifically. You kept pushing the kitty cat is your best friend in the game. And that's how you got me suckered into this.
Well, I mean, the kitty cat has three character models. A real-life looking cat that just happens to be a cat. And then in the sort of underworld part, it's a party member. And also your mode of transportation.
It was so weird. I was just like, Jesus Christ. But yeah, literally, I haven't had this much fun in forever. I've been sucked in. Blair hates you so much for it. Like, I'm having to recharge my controller multiple times a day. Like, oh, fuck, I gotta go through this dungeon, but my controller's dead. Shit.
Gotta buy a second controller now and just cycle them out.
Oh, I'm gonna have to.
All of us hardcore JRPG players do have a second controller, so we swap them out. We never without a controller, son.
My God. Again, this game is amazing. I'm having such a fun time, so thank you so much for that. So now that I've ranted about Persona for a few minutes, Alex, I understand you've got a story for us this week.
Yeah, I've got a little bit of a story here. I've received a little bit of feedback in an email, or not an email, sorry. Received an email, first of all, which I love always getting the fake junk emails from China. Do any of us want to have handbags or knockoff purses made with our logos on them? Because if we do, we have a contact that barely speaks English. but that's a little beside the point. I've saved that email. I'll forward it to you guys. It's pretty good.
Finally.
Yes, finally. We can have all of the Chinese knockoff handbags we could ever imagine. Also, if we want to get into steel and rare mineral mining futures, apparently we have a Chinese contact that will definitely not steal all of our money and not invest it for us. So, now, we did have a fan reach out, a DM tweet to me saying, you know, first-time listener sort of thing. I'm not going to name names just in case the person doesn't want it, but asking me if because we had mentioned that, you know, in Kitchener a bunch of times that that's where I'm located, right? That, you know, have I heard of Dave Sim? Dave Sim, that I should interview him, and he's you know, creator of comic books. I'll give you some background. I replied to said person and said, "Oh, I know Dave Sim." Now, Dave Sim is a comic creator who basically is the first independent publisher, like. Before, when there was Marvel and DC and like Archie Comics, there was nothing else. He started in the 70s as a self-publisher in Kitchener and made Cerebus the Aardvark, which is a series that ran for 300 straight issues monthly that he did with an artist. It is basically, he's the grandfather of independent comic books. Without him, you don't get The Walking Dead. Without him, you don't get Spawn. You don't get anything that wasn't Marvel, DC, or Archie. There was really nobody else. He pioneered it. Without him, there would be no Image Comics. They actually offered him a spot on the board of directors initially, but he declined it. So this guy is hugely influential in the comic book world. He's also out of his fucking mind. So I responded with that. My roommate, about 10, 12 years ago, did a co-op position for him, like a job helping him sort of try to get online. Because the guy's basically a hermit, and he's an absolute control freak. His comic book, Cerebus, was offered like $100 million movie deal at one point, and he turned it down because he wouldn't have complete control over it. Like, he's a complete nut. He doesn't want to do anything with any major company. He doesn't want to do anything unless he has 100% control. He's also a little insane and has created his own religion based on every... He mixes a little bit of Judaism. He mixes a little bit of Islam with a little bit of Christianity, with a little bit of paganism. And he's created his own religion in his own mind. And he's also become a recluse. And he won't go to like Comic-Cons because he one time was called a misogynist and won't go unless 10,000 people sign a petition saying he's not a misogynist. Like, he's that crazy.
Oh dear.
So he's a little bit out of his mind. One of those brilliant guys that apparently I haven't read the comics, but my roommate has all of them because during his co-op he got them all for free, obviously. The guy clearly needs mental help but won't get it sort of thing. And to give you an idea, he was paid, I believe it was an insane sum, like over $100,000 to do one issue of Spawn. Because McFarlane, like basically so influential on that generation of the 90s comic book artists and creators that he's able to sustain himself without working just based on his revenue from his old comic sales that he independently publishes. So to answer that person's question, I won't be interviewing him, but I do know Dave Sim of Dave Sim, and hopefully he gets better one day, but probably not. That being said, he is an interesting fellow, and who knows, if he ever does start going back to comic cons and things, if he ever does get his brain in order, then we'll probably interview him. But until then, he's a little bit crazy.
I like turtles.
Yes, exactly. And other than that, what I've been doing,
how the hell do you follow that up?
I told you guys I wanted to tell a story, and Mike's like, I don't know. Is it going to be horrible? Yeah, probably.
They usually are.
All right, Tristan, what about you? What has been going on with you this week?
It's hard to follow anything like the above stories. I live a pretty mundane life by comparison, apparently. But most of my time has been in the gaming world, of course. I decided to give Borderlands the pre-sequel a try after all the Borderlands 3 hype and anti-hype because of the situation with the Epic Store. It went on sale, so I decided to give it a try, and it is boring as hell. Oh my god. It's not how I remember playing Borderlands. It doesn't really offer anything special. It doesn't capture the same magic, and I think part of that is because it's made by the Australian studio and not the main studio, so it has a slightly different team behind it. It's not necessarily a bad game, it just didn't capture me. I think one of the first things I noticed that was wrong is there is a minimum sensitivity of 10, and it's still far too sensitive on the mouse for me to play properly. It doesn't feel good, it doesn't feel right. So the entire time I'm playing with sensitivity too high, it just feels icky. So I put it down. I put down Borderlands, the pre-sequel, at least for now. I might go back to it and give it a try. And I decided to resub, not to World of Warcraft, for once, because I keep getting sucked back into that one. Instead, I went to the refugee place for World of Warcraft veterans, Final Fantasy XIV. So I've come back to Eorzea, and I'm giving that another go. It's an extremely complicated game. It's very difficult to get back into right away, but man, does it suck you in. Being something made from Square, of course, it's got a lot of polish on it. They're doing a lot of crossover events lately. There's a quest chain for a crossover between Monster Hunter World and Final Fantasy XIV, so there's a Rathalos that you have to go hunt. There's a crossover between Final Fantasy XV and Final Fantasy XIV that just came into the game where you can get a flying car, which is a little out of place in the world, but it's still really cool. I managed to grab that, and I'm pretty excited about getting back into MMOs, because this one actually does take some time to play, but it's really rewarding and feels pretty nice. It's calm. It's not as boring as World of Warcraft has become. There's a lot to do. I've only scratched the surface of how deep the game is, and I've already played for hundreds of hours. But the entire crafting system in Final Fantasy XIV is incredibly detailed. Basically, you have your own classes as crafters, so I haven't dabbled in it at all. So there's still so much left for me to discover, and I've already played for however long I've played now. So I'm excited to get back into the game, and that's about it. It's not exactly an exciting story like an insane person or getting sucked into a new genre of game for 70 hours at a time, but that's me.
Good job. All right, so we got a lot of stuff to talk about this week on the show, from the Marvel Cinematic Universe to a guy throwing an iguana at somebody. There's a lot to cover, plus your usual trio of reviews coming to us from Alex and Mr. Christopher. So we'll be back right here on This Week in Geek, your flagship of stupidity.
From Software is well known for creating difficult games. Dark Souls is their most famous title, and is now used as the reference point for any modern game that truly tests the player. Dark Souls is infamously challenging, yet fair, with their motto of prepare to die. And we did die. A lot. From Software expanded on this with Dark Souls 2 and 3. They also gave us Bloodborne, which plays somewhat differently from the Souls games, requiring a much more aggressive playstyle, and showing us that From Software is no one-trick pony. Enter 2019, and From Software has asked us to die for them once again. Sekiro: Shadows Die Twice will more than likely have you dying far more than just twice. Sekiro is fundamentally different from Dark Souls and Bloodborne, though you still know you're playing a From Software game. One of the first major differences you'll notice is the lack of any character customization. Sekiro means one-armed wolf, and that is who you play as. You don't get to allocate stat points, you don't get to customize your weapons or armor, you are simply Wolf. This lets the game take you on a much more directed journey through the world than previous games. The story is much more pronounced and less hidden than the Soulsborne series, though there's still a tremendous amount of depth to discover in the lore. That's not to say there's no customization at all, however, as earning experience grants you skill points that you can use to unlock various talents and skills for you to use in combat. You also have a selection of shinobi tools that you can attach to your prosthetic arm. You'll need to use just about all of these at some point in your journey, as your purpose as a shinobi is to take out your targets using every means available. With the exclusion of all forms of multiplayer, Sekiro instead focuses on your personal journey, and you'll have to overcome the toughest parts of this game all by yourself, which might be a turnoff for some, but I promise the feeling of beating the boss you've been stuck on for a few hours is an unparalleled rush. One of the biggest additions to your skill set in Sekiro is the ability to jump and hook yourself to grapple points across the map. The added verticality lets you attack enemies from a variety of angles. Death from above can make quick work of your first target, and grappling back up to a rooftop to stalk the next, distracting them with a well-placed shard of ceramic, moving them into just the right spot for you to assassinate. Sneaking through an entire area without being spotted, dispatching enemies one by one, feels pretty good. Though if you're getting stuck on a certain part of the game, it can get a little annoying to have to crawl through the same section of bad guys over and over. The combat is the core of this game, and From Software has made Sekiro's combat as different as possible from its previous works. Sekiro's weapon is a katana named Kusabimaru, and you will not be upgrading or switching it out, so everything revolves around your skill with this blade. Health is important, but works differently than you might expect at first. Dispatching enemies from the lowest grunt to the final boss is achieved only through death blows. In order to open an enemy up to a death blow, you'll need to break your enemy's posture. This is achieved by landing hits and perfectly parrying enemy attacks. The lower your enemy's health, the more posture they will lose, though this also works the other way around, so keeping your health up is important. Bosses and mini-bosses are where you're most likely to hit a wall. Bosses have more than one health bar, needing multiple death blows to eliminate. Some of these can be made easier by sneaking in for a stealth deathblow, but some will lock you into the arena and force you to face them head-on. Of course, even if you're stuck on an infuriating boss, there's a lot to look at, as the feudal Japan-inspired scenery is gorgeous to look at. Combine the stunning visuals with the clanging of swords and the crisp sounds of combat, and you have an immersive environment you can easily lose yourself in. With the option to have the voices in English or subtitled Japanese, you can immerse yourself even further, which I highly recommend. There's so much more to talk about in Sekiro, but part of what makes a From Software game so good is the exploration and discovery, so I'll leave that for you to find out for yourself. In the meantime, I can certainly say that From Software has delivered another incredible experience, well-polished and nuanced as ever. However, if you simply want to check it out because you like Dark Souls, you might be disappointed, since Sekiro sets itself very far apart from what made Dark Souls what it is. Go in with an open mind, and like Yoda once said, you must unlearn what you have learned. I'll be playing Sekiro for years to come, with New Game Plus and different combat styles to try. I've died far more than twice, and many more deaths await. Sekiro: Shadows Die Twice is a must-play for any gamer that likes a good challenge, Soulsborne fan or otherwise. Until the next review, I'm Mr. Tristopher for ThisWeekInGeek.net.
Need a new weapon in your battle against evil? Check out LibrisArcana.com for Canada's premier RPG dice subscription service for only $7.97 Canadian with free shipping. You can get a new complete set of role-playing dice from D4s to D20s delivered straight to your door. Dice themes are new each month and can be anything your mind can imagine and beyond. Visit LibrisArcana.com and subscribe for only $7.97 Canadian with free shipping and be prepared to open up new worlds of adventure.
News on the march!
Welcome back to Twig, your flagship of stupidity. I am one of your hosts, Mike the Birdman Dodd, joined with Mr. Christopher and Alex the producer. And today we're going to kick things off starting with, well, one of the biggest things that's going to happen this week is Marvel's Cinematic Universe is coming to basically not its conclusion, but one of the biggest events in cinema history with Avengers Endgame, which comes out on Thursday/Friday of this week. It's going to be huge. And you'd think that would be the end of Phase 3. Turns out you would be wrong. So Kevin Feige, speaking at an event in Shanghai last week, was talking to fans and said Far From Home, which is the new Spider-Man movie, the second solo outing for him, the second of the Sony deal, that's the end of the Phase 3 of the Marvel movies. Now, this isn't the first time this has happened, because you think back to Age of Ultron. Turns out Ant-Man was the end to that one. So this isn't without precedent. So I throw things to you guys. What do you think the post-credit sequences are going to be for these two movies as it introduces Marvel's Phase 4? Since we're starting to get some news about Marvel's Eternals, we're starting to talk about Thor 4 has been teased in recent weeks. So I'm kind of curious to see what you guys think. What direction does Marvel go into now? Basically, what big bad do you tease? Because we saw Thanos teased at the end of Avengers. Where do we go?
My understanding is that by the end of Endgame, we're going to be made aware of an even greater threat than Thanos. So that kind of opens the door to a lot of really out there possibilities.
Yeah, like, I'm kind of curious, because I don't know how Marvel heads you guys are. Marvel's the company I probably know the most about, DC being the company I know the least amount, and I feel terrible for that. I wonder if it's going to be teasing Annihilus, who's a long-term bad guy from the Avengers. He's like this guy who lives in the negative zone, which is like the anti-universe, so to speak. It's like the universe full of antimatter. Or Galactus, the guy that eats planets. It would be really cool if...
I think it's going to be Galactus, because now that Fox is folded in.
Well, yeah, because now that we have the X-Men, we have the Fantastic Four, which means we have Doctor Doom.
They'll do Fantastic Four before they fold X-Men in, because that'll be... They're going to have to be a little more careful with how they do that. But Fantastic Four hasn't had a good movie ever, so... if they fold it in, you know, obviously Chris Evans won't be in it, because, you know, he was in both franchises and his contract is done, I believe, as of
this game. Yeah.
So I believe probably everybody's going to come back and he's going to die or something. Like, he's probably going to be dead at the end of this movie, or at the end of this phase.
Yeah, both Chris Evans and Robert Downey Jr. have their contracts expiring as of Endgame, so it's likely that at least one of them is going to bite the bullet.
My guess would be they bring back Robert Downey on a case-by-case basis and pay him a shit ton of money to do, like, one movie, maybe, just to tie him, you know, to pass the torch, because this isn't going to be a passing the torch movie. That'll be whatever comes after Spider-Man.
Yeah, like I said, the Spider-Man is the end of Phase 3, so I can see them using that more as the actual, here's how things are post-Endgame, here's the new status quo, this is what you're going to be seeing for Marvel going forward, not Endgame. Endgame is a conclusion, and then Spider-Man is kind of the resolution of what's going on after that. It's a pretty common trope in storytelling in general. This is the climax with Endgame, and then what comes after the climax is... The future of everything, the epilogue.
Now, exactly. What they haven't really done in the MCU yet is a multiverse thing. You know, we saw Into the Spider-Verse, which is, you know, not connected, but I'm wondering if, you know, at the end of Spider-Man, if we see like a post-credit scene where there's another Spider-Man that shows up, or something strange like that, where we start to see like multiverse reality breakdown.
One of the theories that I've seen... One of the theories that I've seen involving the multiverse is suddenly mutants appear, kind of like how we had with Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver, because of the aftermath of the Infinity Stones. Superpowered people are just a thing now, because the barriers between dimensions have been broken down. More people are affected and susceptible to it. So we may see the birth of the mutant. We may see something like that just happen, or the X-Men just appear.
Because that's something that Marvel hasn't done. DC's been very good with on The Flash and I guess the Arrowverse. They do a lot of that, where, for instance, like the original Flash from the 1990 TV show has appeared as Barry's father in the new Flash, but then he's also appeared as his version of the Flash from 1990 in one of the Earths, like a multiverse crossover episode. So they've done really good job with that there. And if they, you know, Marvel, they've been really good at handling a lot of their continuities. I can't see them screwing something like that up. So they might pull in something where, you know, there is a reason to have Hugh Jackman for one scene, pay him $10 million, get in somewhat sort of shape and show up as Wolverine for a minute. Like, they can do something like that. But in more realistically, what they're probably going to do in my mind is obviously Far From Home takes place before Endgame. And it's going to lead up to what happens in Endgame. Or, you know, all the trailers we've seen, they've already admitted, like the Russo brothers and the people in charge are making fake clips for their trailers now that don't actually appear in the movies. So what could end up happening is the maybe three quarters of the way through Spider-Man, you know, is the end. And then the last 25 minutes is what happens after Endgame. Or the very last scene, like we'll have a couple mid-credit scenes. The final credit scene will show, you know, it'll introduce what's going on, or the new Avengers or whomever is still there.
It's kind of funny just to think about, we used to just go to the movies and sure, we'd have our favorite franchises and sequels and whatnot. But now it's not just going to the movies anymore. Marvel has introduced a new cinematic experience where we literally, there's entire podcasts, web shows, television shows, etc., dedicated to talking about what could happen. It's, someone said it on Twitter, and it was somebody famous, and I can't remember who, I really wish I could, but said, we live in a golden age of pop culture right now. Yeah, I can't disagree exactly with that.
The closest I can think of this happening in the past, like we had the occasional, like Mike Myers movies were known to have post-credit scenes, but they weren't consequential to the plot. The closest I could think of prior to this, prior to the whole MCU stuff, is maybe the old James Bond movies, where they would sometimes, they would always have a thing saying James Bond will return and it'll show the title. But occasionally, if a bad guy like Jaws survived at the end of, Spy Who Loved Me before Moonraker? Mm-hmm. And they would do a couple hints of what's happening in the next film, but it was very, very few and far in between. And that was probably the only franchise that even did that, where they'd have a closing scene where they, or closing credit where they showed the next film. So you'd build anticipation. It's like, oh God, next year, the year after, we're having another James Bond and it's called this. So like that was the closest thing until maybe the late 90s when we started getting comedies doing it. And then the only other time I can remember that there was a major thing like this where people waited through 10 minutes of credits to see what was happening next was, my class got to go see I took animation in high school because I was one of the lucky kids who had a school that had an animation program. And we went and saw the Matrix Reloaded. And after the end of that credits, everybody told us, wait, there's going to be something at the end of the credits. We're like, what? And at the end of the credits, they showed, was it like a 3-minute trailer for with some extra cut scenes from
Revolution. Yeah.
We got to see them in the max. And we're like, holy shit. And then we had to wait like a year or two, whatever it was, till it came out.
6 months.
It was only 6 months? Okay.
It was very short.
It felt like forever, but when I was in high school. But that being said, that was the first time where I could see where it really was like, here's what's next. Here's the post-credit scene.
And now you have this culture where even a little teaser trailer or a TV spot for 30 seconds comes out, and within hours you can find a dozen YouTube videos with thousands of views on them, analyzing every frame of the entire trailer, trying to glean some information as to what's going to happen in the next movie, because the hype is just so huge. And that's what we live in now.
Yeah, and the Russos are so brilliant because they've said that all these trailers we've seen for Endgame, they said, anywhere up to 50% of the scenes aren't going to be in the film. And then it's not a case of doing a bait and switch. They're trying to fuck with people because like they're showing, you know, all these people going to, you know, going to do things. Those scenes may not be in it. Those people may not be in it because
they've modified.
You remember the scene from the last, the Infinity War where they showed them all running towards the screen? Well, Hulk's in there all hulked up. He's not hulked up in that scene.
No, there's entire scenes that are filmed and produced that just go into the trailers. Like the line that's famous from the trailers for Infinity War, balance or fun isn't what one considers when balancing the universe, but this puts a smile on my face. It's not in there.
Yeah, exactly. And they it's not a case of like an egregious thing like with the Highlander Endgame movie, where 90% of the scenes weren't in the movie because they hadn't even filmed the movie when they made the trailer and then just tried to basically sucker people into, like, oh, cool, special effects, portals, people splitting in half. None of that shit happened. It ended up being it would have been a cooler movie if it happened. But this is a case of they're purposely trying to deceive you because they know you're going to be analyzing every single scene.
Yeah, there's a lot of misdirection. There's a lot of the early trailers for Endgame where people are kind of catching on to it. There's edited scenes where people are missing from the scene, and people realize that, hey, wait a minute, there's a big space between these two people as they're walking. What's going on there? And more recently, they realize that with a new version of the same scene in a new trailer, well, that's where Nebula and Tony Stark are. Because for the first trailer, we weren't sure if they were going to survive. They were stranded in space. And now the trailers are showing them back on Earth. So obviously they make it somehow. But early on, they were missing because they wanted to keep that mystery there and misdirect.
It's amazing just how much the Russos and the people that cut these trailers have really set up our expectations. Personally, I'm excited for Thursday. I can't wait till I sit in the theater for 4 hours because I have to go an hour beforehand because of the taxis in this town. But still, it's going to be a moment I'm probably going to remember for a long time. And I'm really looking forward to it.
I'm going to see if I can see it on Saturday for like an early matinee. I'm going to actually look probably just after we record because I want to make sure. Like, I know it's going to be packed pretty much no matter when I go, where I go. So for me, if I have to be there for 10 in the morning, it's probably a better chance of seeing it than trying to go at like any other time for the next 2 weeks.
I had to fight with Cineplex's website for 45 minutes to get it to work.
So I best of luck to you. I have the job of avoiding spoilers for 8 days. I have tickets purchased for May 4th to see the movie. So I have to be very
careful. I will promise you that I will not spoil it. I will pretend to spoil it, be very cruel towards that with you, but I will not spoil it.
I've had movies spoiled, but nothing ever too serious before, so I think I can manage.
I will say this. I won't reveal my source. I've had some things spoiled for me, and I know they're legitimate, and it just makes you more hype for this. I gotta say, you guys are in for a treat. That's what I'll say. Moving on to our next story. If you guys remember about 15 years ago, so back in the early days of the internet, Ken Jennings, you remember on Jeopardy, the guy that won roughly $2.5 million?
I remember it's one of the few times I wanted to actually watch the show, yes.
I love Jeopardy, but anyway. Recently, there's been a new guy on the show. His name is James Holzhauser, and he's been working towards breaking Ken Jennings' record. In just 12 episodes, this guy has won $850,000 in just 12 episodes. If he continues at this rate, it's estimated that he'll reach that goal of $2.5 million in less than half the time it took Ken Jennings to actually do so. Basically, last week, he went on the show and won $77,000 in one episode.
As crazy as that is, I'm completely sorry to break in here, but I'm looking up tickets. Did you know that the Avengers Endgame is rated PG in Canada, right? First of all, it's rated PG, which is pretty low. Avengers Endgame IMAX 18A.
Weird.
I just double checked, and the IMAX rating is 18A. Is it a different fucking cut? Because if that's the case, I'm seeing it in IMAX. Sorry, continue on.
Continuing on. So during his 12 episode streak, he's beaten that total not once but five times and has set a new record of $131,127.
Do those machines even have a display for a six-digit number?
I think they had to shrink the font down for it, because I've seen screen caps of this. Now they're attributing his success to being obviously a Google machine in and of itself. He bets insanely high bets on daily doubles, and basically he's really fast at pressing the button. Now, The average person on Jeopardy, when they win, typically wins about $19,000 to $20,000. However, though, this is kind of funny. There's a quote from a game show executive. He's the former head of programming at the Game Show Network, and he says every game show has a prize budget. Typically, for a long-running show, the prize budget is determined by the way of averages of what has been won in the past. This guy's performance, I'm sure, is causing grief for an accountant somewhere, because you look at shows like, say, Survivor, which has a $1 million prize. You know what that's going to be. You know what second place is going to be, what third place is going to be, plus whatever considerations they get for prizes and sponsors, et cetera, et cetera. But Jeopardy, it's so variable, so it's harder to project. So I find this incredibly kind of fun. Just the fact that this guy has made almost $1 million in 12 episodes. Ken Jennings took 74 episodes to get the 2.5 million. This guy's going to do it in half that time. That's impressive as hell to be just that smart.
And it's all trivia. Like, it's not something where this information might be all that useful. He's amassed this information almost specifically to be good at Jeopardy.
Yeah, it's really weird. And there was a clip the other day where he won something on a Justice League question. It was a really deep cut, but it was a Justice League question. So just, holy shit.
Knowledge of everything. Like, it's an insanity. Almost $1 million in 12 episodes of Jeopardy when most people win 20,000 each episode. Like, holy hell. What? How do you study for that much trivia knowledge?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's going to school and university, et cetera, but some of those, like, do you know Khloe Kardashian's, I don't know, shoe size or some bullshit? It's weird because sometimes the questions are worded so weirdly where the answer's obvious, but how they phrase it is strange. So, good for you. I hope you break the bank on Jeopardy. I think that'd be really funny to see them enter a production drought. Say, guys, we got to stop recording for a few months. Why? Because we fucking broke.
My understanding, though, is it's not that expensive for the prizes compared to, say, the budget of salaries and that sort of thing. Like, Alex Trebek has supposedly $10 million a year. So maybe he can take a hit to a bit of his cash flow to fund the rest of the show.
Okay, should I get
don't
dark? Because he's not gonna
don't
need
go
it
there.
Oh god!
But that also kind of, but that kind of makes me think, who can replace Alex Trebek realistically?
Alex Ritchie. I'll grow a killer stash and be a day drunk on television like him.
You're a terrible person. Moving on to our next story.
In all seriousness, nobody thought that Drew Carey could replace Bob Barker, but he did.
And he does a fantastic job.
I'm wondering...
Which, by the way, a friend of the show got called down to Contestants Row last week.
Oh, sweet.
Awesome.
Raheem Jarbo, a.k.a. Mega Ran, was on Contestants Row last week on The Price is Right. So, congratulations.
That's pretty wicked. And wasn't he also at Madison Square Garden for that big...
Ring of Honor.
New Japan Ring of Honor show? Yeah.
Yep.
Now, in seriousness, I think somebody like a Ben Stein, somebody that we know is a smart guy who's already hosted TV before, although Ben Stein is old himself, so... if they weren't looking for a permanent host, maybe they would have rotating hosts or something till they could find somebody. Somebody like Ben Stein would be good because he knows a ton of shit and has the right demeanor for that kind of show. I mean,
Neil deGrasse Tyson.
No, I'm just thinking, just get Will Ferrell to do his impression the entire time. but yeah, like a deGrasse Tyson or somebody like that could host it. You've got to have a little bit of class and decorum for it. You have to have a mustache, right? Like, I know he doesn't have it anymore, but you got to have a mustache to do that show.
I think it's mostly about being able to deliver a little bit of deadpan comedy, but also be very serious at the same time. And just getting the right attitude.
Stephen Wright. Or some other really dry stand-up comedian.
My dog. Now he's gone. Yeah.
I want Robert Downey Jr. to do it, but that ain't gonna happen.
No, you're probably
Avengers Week on Jeopardy would be amazing.
I mean, again, it was so surprising that Drew Carey, and he does a really good job on Wheel of Fortune, or not Wheel of Fortune, stupid, Price is Right. I don't know, same thing, actually, think about it. Pat Sajak's been doing Wheel of Fortune forever. Who's going to replace him? Like, we're getting to the point where a lot of these guys have been doing it over 30 years. So, it's going to be interesting. They won't cancel the show. I mean, between those three shows, those are the longest running game shows ever. So, and they get ratings. So, I'm wondering, I don't think he has anybody in mind. Like, his plan is to come back in the fall, he said, after the hiatus, and as long as his health is still good.
Mm-hmm. So I guess we'll have to wait and see what happens. Of course, we wish Alex Trebek the best of recoveries with his cancer. But I can't wait to see what this guy's going to do when he continues to demolish the Jeopardy records. Moving on to our next story. This one, if you're a fan of Game of Thrones, and most of us are, we're not going to talk about spoilers. We're going to talk about episode 1, Winterfell, of season 8, which just premiered last week on HBO. Evidently, in one day, this show was pirated 54 million times, according to a digital analytics company. Now, that number is insane. Yeah.
Consider there are less than 400 million people in North America. I mean, more countries than just North American countries did the pirating, but just as a comparison point.
Well, the big thing for them is Warner Brothers has been, out of all the movie studios, the one that has, and they're the parent company of HBO, they've been the most lenient when it comes to piracy, in that even when the first season came out, they weren't cracking down on piracy. They were actually using piracy in their analytics numbers for developing budgets for their next shows, especially with Game of Thrones. Because what they were finding in the first season, they had an average of about 1 million viewers. Now they're at about 12, which is insane that every single season they've built viewers. That's never happened for a TV show in history, where they've had 7 or 8 or 9 consecutive years where every episode gets more viewers than the last. So it's almost like a Guinness record. So what they've done, though, is they went, okay, we had 1 million viewers average for our first season, but they sold between 3 and 5 million sets of the DVDs and Blu-rays. So they went, well, it's not just magically, there's going to be some people that buy it because of word of mouth, but they were realizing that there was a correlation between people that were pirating it that couldn't afford to pay $20 or $30 a month for HBO, especially before they had the separate mobile app. But they're like, we can't afford $50 for a DVD set. So they were pirating it and then buying it. So they were actually converting people from piracy to purchasing. And they're the only company I know of that's actually gone and said, hey, it's okay if you pirate it if you can't afford it, because we know you're going to buy it later. And it's paid off for them in dividends. Because look at this. They actually would advertise, I think it was 4 or 5 years ago, they said, they actually released a statement saying, we are the most pirated show in history.
It's insane just to think how many times this thing was pirated, because I'm looking at some of the data from this. The episode was reportedly most pirated in India with 10 million people, and then China with 5 million.
So you add all this up, right? So they said 54 million pirated copies. They had 12 million live people watching it and PVR. They said it was a total of
17.4 million.
That's including streaming apps, iTunes, and Amazon copies. So you add all that together, and you're more than the Super Bowl of households that watched it. You're actually at, including piracy, you're at a number that exceeds sporting events, and we're talking big sporting events. That hasn't happened since like MASH ended.
Or MASH, Seinfeld.
When Seinfeld ended, it didn't even get that many. That's like, that's about on par, if not more people, probably more people than Friends. Like, I think that's the highest number since MASH, that for a scripted show, because sporting events don't count, or pay-per-views and all that sort of crap. But specifically, like, they can view that as a huge win. And I imagine that, like, the 17 million that paid to watch, I guarantee you that the last 4 episodes will be watched by more than the first couple, because you're going to get people that are willing to pay the $20 to subscribe for the last month. And you're probably going to see 100 million people, including piracy, watch it when it's the very last episode.
I can't think of an event that will draw more people together other than the Super Bowl. You're absolutely right. I mean, it's amazing to see how much Game of Thrones has changed the television landscape in terms of storytelling, how far they're willing to push the envelope, and not just for the sake of sex and violence, but for the sake of storytelling. You can make an argument that some of the early Game of Thrones stuff was unnecessarily brutal, but it is what it is.
Pretty close. And I mean, you know, you're never going to convert some people that don't like beheadings. Ew, fantasy.
I watched for 15 minutes. Clearly, I know what I'm talking about. Fuck off. Yeah, I'm sorry. I got to talk about that for a minute. You do not get to consume a piece of media for 15 minutes and say you gave it a chance. No, shut your fucking mouth. You do it for the full hour, then you can have a fucking opinion. 15 minutes, fuck you.
This is a show, and it's not a case of I'm always like, oh, you got to watch the whole show to get, you know, or whole season to get really into it. This is a show where if you're not...
It's a slow burn.
I was immediately hooked, but if you're not immediately hooked, if you're willing to make it to basically the first time you experience an episode 9, you know, the trope is the episode 9 is always the crazy episode out of the 10. Once you hit the very first episode 9, you're like, holy shit, and then you're hooked forever. But basically, if you really don't like fantasy and stuff, if you want to use that excuse, or I can understand if you're very religious or something and you're turned off by the sex, probably the violence shouldn't turn you off, because how is it any different than watching, you know, giant robots make things explode? I mean, beheadings are, is it because it's more realistic? Is it because it's very, like, I would say the violence in this is, you know, no worse than The Sopranos.
And no worse than Walking Dead.
The Sopranos has the honor, I believe, of being, I think they had about 18 million people pay to watch it. But that's also at a time, like the last couple seasons, I think had that many. That's at a time when you still, you know, I remember in high school, there were a lot of people that were just getting into torrenting and stuff. That wasn't a big deal then, the piracy. It was very, very niche. So people still paid for cable more so than they do now. But even then, The Sopranos didn't get the kind of buzz worldwide that this got, except maybe the first two seasons where, do you remember when it aired on CTV and they had those crazy warnings and it was all uncensored? And for our American listeners, CTV is our equivalent of like CBS.
A national broadcaster, yeah.
You pick it up with bunny ears, and they would have a warning at the beginning that said, and they had a warning every 10 or 15 minutes, even when they didn't have a commercial, it would pop up and say, the following program is intended for mature audiences. Viewer discretion is advised. The content inside here will be offensive to some adult viewers. I've never heard them say that before, but they aired, I think, the first two seasons completely uncut on national broadcast television at like 8 or 9 at night. So that was an experiment.
Yeah, and I remember when CTV aired The Sopranos relatively uncut early.
That's
on
what I'm saying. It was The Sopranos. Yeah. That's what I was talking about.
I thought you meant Game of Thrones.
Oh, they haven't done that. So I'm saying, like, that was an experiment then. I wouldn't be surprised, you know, if in the next few years, because the show, it will have entered, I guess, basic syndication, because we just had episode 69 air. but we're going to hit a point where we're able to show this on normal TV. It might be a while. Could you imagine who is scrambling up right now to try to get the broadcast rights to this now that the show's almost ending?
Yeah, it's going to be a massive bidding war. I mean, the show, you can think of it what you want, but it's a cultural juggernaut. It's going to change television forever. And this was considered unfilmable. The original pilot, I think, was scrapped.
They said it was too violent, too this, too that. And one thing I will give Warner is they let HBO do what they wanted, even though they're the parent company. They said, go ahead. If this first season fails, you know, we'll scrap it and do something else. And look what they're doing now. They're spending multiple hundreds of millions of dollars on the season.
And there's going to be a prequel series set long before the War for the Iron Throne, which will probably premiere in like a couple years.
That won't do very well, to be honest. It'll do well for the first episode, but like, what can you do unless you really, it can't be about the same region. They need to expand the world and show other parts of the world.
It'll be, if I had to wager, it'll be about High Valyria. It'll be more about the mysticism and the First Men.
Which would be good. Guess. And make it shorter. Make it a mini series. You know, make it 8 episodes, but make each episode like an hour and 10 minutes or something, and then go from there. You could do that. You make a whole bunch of anthology series based on the universe.
Yeah. I mean, the sky's I mean, basically, there's the world of Westeros, which is only one continent. We haven't seen what's happened in Essos or Pentos, really, outside of Dany's conquering of it.
Focus on the bank.
The Iron Bank.
Because the Iron Bank views Westeros as a nothing. Like, every time we've seen them, and I haven't read the books, but every time they talk about them, they view Westeros the throne and everything. They don't view it as even worth investing in unless they think they can get something. So they're obviously more invested in the rest of the world, which the rest of these people don't even focus on, because in their mind that's so far away to travel that they don't even think. So we don't even know how big this world is. We've only seen one continent and part of another, the one where the Dothraki come from.
Yeah.
And that's only a section of the world. And the bank doesn't even care. They're just like, yeah, whatever. Can we get something out of this? So that's what I want to know is, how did that bank start? How much do they own? What are they in control of? Like, the fact that they don't really care about, they would know about the White Walkers, and they don't care because it's not a big enough threat to them.
It'll be interesting to see what happens with the world of Game of Thrones going forward. I gotta say, I'm already looking forward to next week, which is going to be the Battle of Winterfell, and
that's the first episode that's going to be over an hour, and then the rest are all going to be over an hour, right?
It's going to be fantastic. Moving on to our last story. This one was hard to avoid this week in the news. As you well know, the Notre Dame Cathedral in France had some major structural damage this week due to a fire that was allegedly caused by an electrical short. So rebuilding it is considered a worldwide priority. Think of that what you will. Donations are coming in from Amazon, Disney, multiple billionaires. That's not important. However, rebuilding it's going to be a challenge because it's such an old building. It has such a unique architecture. However, one of the tools that's been cited in helping rebuild it is coming from an unlikely source. A couple of years ago, there was an Assassin's Creed game set in France, Assassin's Creed Unity, which was met with not favorable reviews, but its recreation of period France was basically said to be really, really on point, especially its recreation of the Notre Dame Cathedral itself, which people spent years literally creating textures in the environment to make sure everything looked as possibly good as it could, as accurate as it could. So the Assassin's Creed Unity engine and its digital files will help rebuild the Notre Dame Cathedral moving forward. Now, allegedly, this rebuilding will take anywhere between 5 to as long as 15 years to rebuild. So, I gotta say, I think it's important from a World Heritage standpoint. Do I believe this money could be put to other more humanitarian causes? Absolutely, like the water in Flint, Michigan. But taking the politics aside out of this, I do think it's cool how a video game is going to be used to help rebuild one of the most iconic places in the in Europe. So your guys' thoughts on this?
It goes to credit the designers of Unity's environment. Say what you will about the actual game itself, but Assassin's Creed has been well known for their accurate representations of the periods in which they take place, and the fact that they put so much effort into detailing the Notre Dame Cathedral, I mean, I guess it's really paying off overall, because now they have a source material to say, hey, you know, we can...
Did we lose Tristan?
No, Tristan is just fine.
Okay, so some technical issues aside, the recreation of the cathedral by the people that made the game, they put so much effort and work into it, and it's probably not what they expected their work to go towards. I hope it's not what they expected their work to go towards, but they have to feel a certain sense of pride that they're able to contribute to rebuilding this monument to human architecture and human production, just the things that we can make as a species, the wonder of the world sort of deal.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible just to think that how much effort and thought went into this for a video game. This is a location you don't even have to visit that often in the actual game itself if you don't want to. So the fact that it's even optional is quite incredible, and just you can explore it physically. I remember spending a lot of time in the game there because I'd like to jump across the roof of Notre Dame Cathedral. So this is cool, and I don't think you can get it anymore, but last week on Uplay, Ubisoft was giving away copies of Assassin's Creed Unity on PC, which now works fine. So
good.
Yay!
Ubisoft's kind of stepping up and making sure that people are aware of what's going on, making sure that they're as involved as they can. I believe they put a donation in as well to help the rebuilding process.
I think so, too. If anything, Ubisoft has given me a deeper appreciation of history, and that's one thing the Assassin's Creed games have definitely given me, and I definitely do thank them for that. Speaking of that, we will have a review of Assassin's Creed 3 Remastered probably coming up the week after next. I just have to get through, I have to get through Endgame and everything else this week before I can even think about playing another video game. But there will be some Assassin's Creed content coming up here on the show. But that's going to do it for us so far for the news that has been this week. We're going to take an extended look at a game that Alex had a chance to play this week. And what was that game called again, Alex?
That was Legend of Heroes Trails of Cold Steel 1, the remastered edition for PS4.
So we'll be looking at that right after this, right here on This Week in Geek, your flagship of stupidity. I've been Mike the Birdman Dodd, joined with Alex the producer and Mr. Christopher. We'll be back, guys, right after this.
Past few weeks, I've had the pleasure of playing through one of my favorite games from the PS3 era, remastered on the PS4, and that's The Legend of Heroes Trails of Cold Steel. Now, what is Trails of Cold Steel, or what is Legend of Heroes for that matter? Legend of Heroes actually dates back to, I've had to do some research on this because it's pretty convoluted history, to the Dragon Slayer series. Now, that is, I believe, the first JRPG series to ever exist back in the early 80s. Predates Final Fantasy, Phantasy Star, Dragon Quest, all that stuff. So, you know, it started as that. It was like the fourth or fifth entry in the series was renamed Legend of Heroes, and then it spawned off from there. Now, the Legend of Heroes series spawns, it basically takes place, a lot of it, on the same planet, but there's sub-series or meta-series that are then dealing with certain countries or certain aspects of that planet and certain timelines. So the best example I can give is if you're a big Persona fan, you know, Persona is actually a sub-series of the Shin Megami Tensei series. So this is a similar idea. Now, Trails of Cold Steel is, I believe, the second or third iteration in the series. Each Trails game takes place in a different country within the same continents that are sort of, you know, rivals. So you get a sort of perspective where not everybody is bad, not the enemy. Like, the enemy in this game is this country. Well, you play the next game and that you're playing in that country and you realize that they're not evil either. And then there's politicians and craziness and overarching stories of having, you know, shadowy government organizations that are, you know, not part of the real government. They're part of, like, the Illuminati sort of thing involved. And, you know, you can't get too much into it without going into the plot of every single game, so I won't. But basically, here's how it goes. Trails in the Sky was the first series. There's three games in that series that came out, and they're sort of the traditional RPG. They are turn-based, but they're sort of strategy-based in the way they look, isometric. Basically, an extension of the Super Nintendo era, Super Nintendo / original PlayStation era sprite work. Fun games in their own right, but not going to take the world by storm. You have to already be a pretty hardcore fan to like those. So, what do we get here? We go and get the next. There's four games in this series, two of which have already been released, and then with the third one coming out later this year, and then probably the fourth one after that, is the Trails of Cold Steel. So Trails in the Sky is obviously about a country whose predominant power is that they have airships. Well, Trails of Cold Steel is about a country very Germanic in nature that relies heavily on their rail system that they've developed that no other country really has. Nothing this powerful. And deals with railroad military, and you basically are a... You play Reen, a character who is going to high school, and you're going to high school at a sort of a military training school for the government. Now, the government is split into multiple levels. There is a very big caste-based system in this country of Erebonia. You have the royals, like the imperial family. You also then have the four families that are the highest noble families in the lands, and they control different provinces within the country. And they have their own military. Basically, a good example in Canada would be we have our provincial police officers, and then you have your federal police officers, which are the Mounties. And it's that sort of getup. And the nobles dislike or, you know, snub their noses at the poor people, the regular folk. The Imperials are sort of, they own the military that defends the entire country, and they have a city of their own. And there's politics involved, but it's never boring in the game. You get introduced to it bit by bit, and it's never over, you know, never overwhelming at all, and never feels like, oh God, I'm learning about politics of a country. No, you're learning about things as you play. You know, there's certain provinces that don't like each other, and there's problems. And you basically are part of a group called Class 7. The school traditionally only had five classes, and you're now the special new class, Class 7, where they've taken people from the nobility as well as the commoners, and they've mixed them all together. And you're sort of going out and you're representing the school, but also learning about how the world works. And there's sort of undertones of the school wanting to show your class specifically, make a choice for yourself. What's wrong with this country? Maybe you can fix it. You know, that sort of thing. They're explaining, they're showing them, you know, all aspects of the world. And you sort of get the hints that you're doing the jobs of what are called bracers. Now, in Trails in the Sky, bracers, it's a job that you basically do. It's sort of like a bounty hunter slash guild club. You go and you take on jobs to help people in towns and get rewards. Same thing here. You slowly learn that throughout the game. That's one aspect I'll mention. I don't want to spoil the plot, but there are giant mechs in this too. And it's sort of a steampunky mixed with futuristic mechy sort of thing, yet sort of takes place around 1900 or so. There's telephones, there's radio, but you know, no television really yet. It's only new, yet they have computers. So there's sort of this weird hybrid. It's really exciting. Now, how does this tie in to the rest of the series as a whole? This is again about Erebonia, which is at war with other countries like Crossbell, and those other countries to have their own games. But these are basically the main games. Trails of Cold Steel 1 and 2 were released on the Vita and on the PS3. I had played the PS3 versions. They were probably two of the last games released for the system that were unique in that they weren't, you know, sports titles. I think only Persona was the only thing that came out after that. So you get them, and what have they done here? They've gone and remastered it so that instead of running on the original engine that was basically, the PS3 version was just an upgraded version of the Vita version. This is playing at 4K with brand new dialogue. I believe they said it was like so many hundred lines of dialogue that are extra spoken. I didn't personally notice it doing my full playthrough because I played the first game so much I knew what they were saying. I didn't notice any new dialogue, but that's good because it means that they blended it seamlessly in. So as far as anything else that was added, the most important features, there was already a new game plus in the old game. What they added here that's really, really good for somebody like myself is there is a fast forward option. So you can actually hold down the circle button while people are talking and it goes faster and faster, and you can just get to make your choices when you're talking or something else. And press the L2 button, turns on turbo mode, which means that when you're seeing a cutscene, it plays at 1.5 times the speed, but the voices still play at normal speed, so you can listen to that. Then when you're in battle or on the map, in battle it goes like 2 or 3 times faster. It's a lot faster. Basically, it doubles or triples your walking and running speed, so you can get through a lot of things faster in here, especially if you're like me and you've played through it once or twice before and already had put in your 40, 50 hours or more into the game. So it also has, it's an RPG that's sort of a hybrid of a lot of the best of every type of RPG out there. There's mini games like fishing you can do. There's a dating aspect, but not really like Persona where you're dating. You're trying to get the morale up of all of your fellow classmates, and the bonds you create help your battle. In battle, when you're finishing off an enemy or attacking an enemy, if your bond is strong enough, it can trigger sort of randomly extra attacks that your connected people can do with you. So the whole point is to raise your your link level to level 5 with every character. And you do that by going to different cutscenes with them and helping them out, buying them books. Certain things in the game will help you raise that link status, or fighting with them in battle in linked mode will gain you link experience. So each character is very unique. They all are voiced. They're voiced very well, which is, you know, a nice change, because a lot of times that's the weakest point of these JRPGs, is you have a whiny person or a person with bad vocals or something. No, this is pretty straightforward, pretty well done. It's released by XSEED. They've done a fantastic job of actually going through and adding and remastering things. And these were features that were available in a PC version that came out a little while ago, but they seem to work best on my PS4. I played it on my PS4 Pro, and the visuals, while they do look like a big jump up, the big problem I have with it is it's still based initially on graphics that were on like a 540p screen. So they're not jagged edges or anything, but everything seems to have less fidelity than what you'd be used to on a PS4. But that's to be expected. It's also, the game is, I believe, $20 or $30 cheaper than a full retail. So at like $50-$55, it's well worth picking up for all those special features. And if you get it physical, you end up getting a few little trinkets with it that you usually get with JRPGs. So, you know, when it was originally reviewed, it had a Metacritic rating of like 87 or 88%. I would say take that, and then it's probably about the same now, because while the visuals don't hold up as much as they did, we're talking, I guess, 4 years ago now. Those added features of fast forwarding and turbo mode have really, really helped in my enjoyment of it, and that I was able to grind through really quickly. If I had to grind through an area where, let's say, you have to hunt down 10 of these types of monsters, you can do it in the time it takes you to do 2 normally, because you can just be a lot faster. And like I said, there's aspects of this game that are amalgamated. So there's the relationship building, there's all the mini games, there's a swimming mini game. You are sort of strung along a path. You're not able to really go too many places you're not supposed to go. And that doesn't come into play until the second game, when you're able to retrace your steps and go and do things on your own. You are stuck on a schedule in that you have days where you're in classes, where you have to answer questions. You have days where you're then on field trips or practical exams. And then you have certain times that are free days where you can build your relationships with people. After you do that, you sort of repeat the cycle, and you have midterms even that you have to study on, so you can read things. It's very much like Persona in that sense. The battle system shines quite well as being one of the best modern turn-based battle systems I've seen. You never enter a battle without seeing the enemy, because you see them on the field, and you can slash at them, and if you get them from behind, it gives you a bonus. There's a whole bunch of stuff in here. It's like you took the best parts of the battle system of Final Fantasy X, mixed it with like a Tales game, but made it turn-based. And I can't recommend it enough. I can't wait. I believe in May they're releasing the second game's remastered version, which I'm hoping I get a chance to review, because, you know, later on in the year we're going to be getting the third game and maybe the fourth game coming after. If you are not a fan of JRPGs, is this one to get you into it? I would say it's one to check out for sure, because it does give you a great tutorial on how to play when you're first starting. So it's one that you can get into with it. It's not going to be the definitive RPG of its generation, and by any means. It is one of the most fun, probably my top. This series is in my top 10 of all time as far as personal enjoyment. So it's going to be one that I hope that somebody like Birdman will check out, because he hadn't been traditionally a JRPG fan, but he got super into Persona 5 over the last few weeks. So I'm really hoping that he will then go and maybe check this game out next. So, I can't praise it high enough. That is Legend of Heroes Trails of Cold Steel 1 Remastered Edition, which you're going to definitely want to check out on PS4.
What makes you qualified to be a reporter?
I'm willing to violate anyone's privacy for my personal gain and then claim with a straight face that the public has a right to know.
By the hand of Zeus, what manner of deviltry is this?
I love fake alien poop day.
Welcome back, and thank you, Alex, for that extended review of that particular game, whose name I completely forget right now. But that's
Trails
okay.
Trails of Cold Steel.
Trails of Cold Steel. Sorry about that, guys. Anyway, We are here to talk about the weird, wacky, and the just plain fucked up things that happened on planet Earth this week. And we're going to start things off on, once again, ethical concerns. Because science, you just couldn't leave it alone, could you? So scientists this past week have partially revived disembodied pig brains, raising huge questions. So, evidently, researchers from Yale have developed a system capable of restoring some functionality to the brains of decapitated pigs for at least 10 hours after death. Neuroscientists, I can't even begin to pronounce this guy's name, have developed a system which is to restore circulation and some cellular functionality to intact pig brains removed from the skull. Basically, for 4 hours after death, these brains were declared, and after dead and severe oxygen starvation or anoxia has set in, the system pumped synthetic blood and other components into the disembodied organ, restoring partial functionality for a period of 6 hours. However, though, that being said, the brains did not exhibit signs of consciousness or awareness, and the researchers took extra precautions to ensure that didn't happen. The pig heads were acquired from a nearby food processing plant, so no pigs were deliberately killed for the experiment. The researchers took extra efforts to consult with and receive approval from multiple ethics bodies, including the Institutional Animal Care and Use of Committee at Yale University and the Neuroethics Working Group of the U.S. National Institute of Health. Now, the ability to restore partial functionality to a mammalian brain after death could result in a new model for studying brains and new medical interventions for diseases or conditions where the brain is starved of oxygen, such as, and not limited to, strokes. However, at the same time, this new achievement is straining our notion of death and when it should be declared, a development with implications ranging from animal experimentation through to human organ donation. So, this is scary.
It kind of takes the premise of death being when your brain stops working and changes it fundamentally. If you can be hooked up to this BrainX thing for hours at a time, like, you're not going to be consciously aware of anything. You're not really going to be alive, but you're also not really dead. You're kind of in this state where you're in between life and death.
Yeah, because, like, as it stands now, neuroscientists can only sustain brain cells in a lab for a few weeks, and that's a far cry from being able to study an intact brain. So this raises to me a lot of ethical concerns. Like you said, what is dead? Like, brain death. I mean, because obviously that's when blood starts pumping and the brain is starved of oxygen. I don't know, man. Like, this is, we're getting into that cyberpunk future now where we're starting to look at the idea of resurrection, I would say. I mean, that's a far cry there, but this is the baby steps towards, okay, you've been brain dead for 6 hours. Maybe we can fix you anyway.
T-minus, like, 10 years till we have the reanimator.
I'm thinking probably 25, personally.
I think it doesn't raise any questions at the moment that, like, the churches are going to freak out over. They aren't already freaking out over. They'll freak out as soon as something comes back alive and can behave exactly like it always did.
Or at least some facsimile of it. I feel like there's going to be a lot of barriers to full resurrection of anything that has fully died. Like, something's going to be wrong. There's going to be some sort of deterioration of something that can't quite be reproduced. Like, neurons and the way they work with synapses, it's really difficult to repair that damage. So I don't know.
What would be interesting is, you know, couple this, let's say 50 years down the line, barring any major disaster or some end of the world scenario, if we can get to a point where somebody, let's say, has some,
like,
sort of,
like, those cryogenics things.
Yeah, basically somebody's dying and we're able to freeze them so that they're basically dead, but not completely dead. And then if we can revive them from that, once we've got, you know, a cure to whatever disease they have, that might help. Or it might help something like Alzheimer's patients. People, basically early onset stuff. You can't repair something once your brain is turned into Swiss cheese. But once, let's say you've got a neurological disorder that you're like, we can't fix yet, it's going to kill you, you have the choice. we can put you into a deep sleep coma slash death now and revive you later. But again, where do you get to the point where you have to prove that that works? Because you bring somebody back and they're just like, and they're like a complete zombie, or they're completely brain dead and on a machine. What good is that?
Yeah, like this, I wonder how this will be applied to something like cryogenics, because I know the big deal with cryogenics right now is the freezing process works, but it's reviving them, and that mostly comes down to cell crystallization, and basically because there's water in our cells pop, and that's bad. But this talking about brain death and whatnot.
I really like that movie Forever Young with Mel Gibson.
As do I, actually. I saw that movie when I was a kid, and I cried because it made me really, really, really sad. But anyway, I wonder where this is going to go. I do think having applications for stroke victims and Alzheimer's, I think there's a lot of potential there for some good. But like you said, the big test is if we can bring something back and have it behave exactly as it once was. And I think that implication's at least 20, 25 years off. However, though, as we discussed in last week's show where we briefly had a talk about supervillains, I wonder what goes on in labs that aren't necessarily stuff that's going reported right now. Obviously, they don't have the resources of a Yale.
It depends on the country.
And the country, yeah, because the ethics laws are a little bit more flexible in certain countries.
I'm willing to bet that there isn't a lab in Canada whatsoever that is doing something that unethical.
Scary.
Because
yeah, there is
just too much oversight, and we're too it's not a case of like you can have oversight in a country that has a different set of ethics than we do, but we like whatever when you see in like American TV and they're like, you know, we have these strong medical ethics. And it's like, well, we are sort of at the level that they pretend to be as far as what we can and can't do that way. Things take longer to go through. Like, before you can even get approved to do trials here, there's a lot more you go through than what you have to go through in the States or a lot of other countries. I can't see anything crazy happening in England. A lot of Northern European countries, I can't see it happening. Where you're going to see issues like this pop up is in the developing world, where there's huge discrepancies between who's rich and who's poor. So you have these super duper rich people that are willing to give money to do experiments on super duper poor people. And the poor people will take it because they're like, well, this way my family doesn't starve. And if I die, I die. But at least my family doesn't starve.
It's weird. It's scary. It's something that's unpleasant to think about. So we're going to move on from this topic.
Okay, but before you do, my ongoing story of Avengers continues. I now have a ticket, which is good.
Excellent.
At least we got some joy out of this
quiet.
Moment.
I've been quiet because I was looking, and Cineplex is bonkers crazy. They're booked almost all the way through, and I don't want to sit way in the left corner beside somebody I don't know. They're putting you in a few different weird spots. So everything is sold out. I was going to go see it in IMAX at the Landmark Studio or Landmark Theater here. That's pretty much sold out, and it's only spotty all the way through till Saturday. But I got a ticket for a theater that only at Landmark that only has like 10 seats sold right now, and it is the Friday the 26th.
Yes,
Friday the 26th at noon in 3D. Which
hey,
normally
so
I don't
bad.
Go for. I wouldn't go for it because the 3D glasses don't always fit over my glasses. But I remembered. I bought myself clip-on glasses that are 3D clip-on glasses, so I can see it that way. Usually, if I see 3D, I prefer IMAX because the glasses are so much bigger, they go over mine. But that being said, I will see it, and then I will horribly, horribly troll Mr. Christopher with it for a week.
Nothing but false spoilers.
No, I won't do that. But that way, when I end up meeting up with Birdman here, we'll actually be able to talk about it, because you're going to see it the night before, right?
Yes.
So, yes, I will see it in 3D. Unfortunately, I'm not seeing it in the IMAX 3D where it says it's 18A. I'm pretty sure that's just a flub. Because
that's an error.
Our rating board doesn't rate two movies different unless, or two types of screens different unless there's a major difference in the footage.
Exactly.
The Scarlett's sex scene is removed in the PG cut.
Well, I mean, fuck. It's pretty, you know what? Honestly, she doesn't do anything for me. She may as well be a blow-up doll.
I love her red hair, but... She's blonde in this one. So anyway, moving on. This story is Well, weird. Otherwise, it wouldn't be here. So police say an unruly customer in a restaurant in Ohio pulled an iguana from under his shirt, swung it around his head, and threw it at the manager. So Painesville police were called to a Perkins restaurant around noon on Tuesday. Arnold Teeters walked into the business with his pet Copper on his shoulder. Once seated, police say that Teeter laid down in the booth, threw a menu at the waitress, and started yelling. That's when the manager got involved. Teeter then pulled Copper from under his shirt and swung his pet at the manager but missed him. Copper landed on the floor in the foyer. Teeter picked Copper up by the tail and left. The manager called police but they couldn't find him when they eventually did arrive. Eventually, they did find him at the YMCA. Dash cam video shows the man waving through traffic as multiple cars were swerving to avoid him. After a struggle, Teeter was arrested and police found Copper under his shirt. The 49-year-old was charged with disorderly conduct, resisting arrest, and animal cruelty. Police say Copper had a fracture in her leg that requires surgery and part of her tail is missing.
Well, that's not good.
Police say the lizard was taken to the Lake County Humane Society to be checked out by a veterinarian.
You know what? At first you're like, this should be a Florida story. But then you realize, no, there's not enough feces or guns for it to be a Florida story.
Or bath salts.
Yeah, no one's eating any faces here.
So this is just a Florida man, I'm assuming, outside of Florida.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. He's on vacation. So who carries a pet iguana with
him? What I'm seeing happen is...
It's Ohio. You know it's not crazy because, first of all, none of the people around him were also crazy. Everybody swerved around him. Nobody else got hurt. So it's like, this literally is like a Florida man out of Florida.
I can see this being a lot of drugs, of course, but then going on a Game of Thrones binge and thinking he's the mother of dragons and just throwing an iguana at somebody going, go get him.
I am the lizard queen.
Go get him, Drogon. Go get him. Poor lizard.
Yeah, I know. Animal cruelty, really. Something, a little detail that kind of makes me laugh is that he had to swing the lizard around his head first. Like, how much extra energy you're getting from flinging this thing that way. Just,
I'm picturing the music from Star Trek, you know. Picturing that playing or like
the crazy cat lady from the Simpsons.
Yeah, or the scene from Cable Guy when they're at medieval times.
Just what a fucking weirdo.
Lizards at home, people.
Exactly. Don't bring them out to Perkins of all places. And this story comes to us courtesy of Alex. A 40-year-old man who moved back into his parents' home after a divorce is suing his folks after they allegedly destroyed his porn stash, which he estimates to be worth nearly $30,000.
Good God.
Or half of what your porn stash is worth, right, Mike?
I don't have it anymore. We mostly destroyed it.
What was that? My mom destroyed it.
My man.
Do you need this big pile of porn? No.
According to a federal civil court documents obtained by the news station, the man, only identified as Charlie, filed the lawsuit in the state of Michigan last week where he moved in with his parents in 2016 following a divorce. He stayed with his parents for a period of 10 months doing housework in lieu of paying rent. According to the news station, he was asked to leave the home after police were called to the house in August 2017 for a domestic dispute. He then moved to Indiana, and in November of 2017, his parents traveled to his new home to drop off some of his possessions that he had left behind. But according to the man, some stuff was missing. His massive porn collection was not among the boxes dropped off. The parents told their son they had destroyed the pornography, which he estimated to be worth $29,000, including such titles as Frisky Business, Big Bad Grannies, Charlie called the police after learning of the destruction of his collection, which consisted of 12 moving boxes full of pornography, plus 2 boxes of sex toys.
Jesus.
But the authorities declined to press charges against the parents. According to the lawsuit, Charlie began to email his parents about a month after filing a police report, telling his folks they behaved vindictively. If you had a problem with my belongings, you should have stated that at the time, and I would have gone elsewhere, reads an excerpt of an email. Instead, you chose to keep quiet and behave vindictively. the father allegedly responded to the son, explaining why they had tossed out the copious amount of porn. Believe it or not, one reason for why I destroyed your porn was for your own mental and emotional health. I would have done the same if I had found a kilo of crack cocaine. Someday I hope you will understand. The man is seeking triple financial damages, worth roughly $87,000.
Is that really the you know, the hill you want to die on? Like, you want to sue your parents? They're probably going to die
on porn hill.
Yeah, I've died on poon hill.
Two boxes of sex toys.
You know what? You know, two. Okay, here's the thing: two boxes of sex toys. I could see that. I guess it's not my deal, but I could see that. It's the massive amount of boxes of porn. All joking earlier aside, like this
porn is not cheap.
There is, well, I mean, especially, like, first of all, if the guy's young enough to understand how to use streaming sites, but the fact that he has a very particular taste, it sounds like, you know, with the grannies and all that stuff, that it might be, you know, that he had rare stuff that he won't be able to re-get again. But you know what? I'm wondering how much of this had to do with his breakup and domestic issue the first time.
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. I mean,
it sounds like a case of potential addiction to pornography, which is a real thing and very damaging to relationships.
He freaked out enough to publicly sue his parents and go to the news about it.
For triple damage, too.
Massive,
not just the value.
Porn collection. Massive porn collection. Where the guy has more boxes of porn than I had. Like, I think when I moved into my apartment, I had like tote bins that I used for all my stuff. I think I had 20 tote bins for everything I owned.
Yeah, to have all these moving boxes of porn, like, I can't imagine that. 12 moving boxes, that is not a small amount.
Now, the only thing I would have said is, I mean, it's a bit of the Bible Belt that he's in, sort of the outskirts of it, so I can understand why the parents were, you know.
Michigan?
No, is it? I thought you said Indiana.
No, he moved to Indiana, but his parents' house was in Michigan.
Yeah, there's no Bible Belt thing. So, you know what? I would think, honestly, the parents, what they probably could have done is, sell it, like, bring it to a porn store or something, or sell the lot of it and then use the money to give to the son to get a better start or something. Because that's that there, even though porn after second market, I'm assuming, is not very big, you could have got a couple hundred bucks for all that shit.
Maybe. Selling pornography secondhand is typically not. It's typically frowned upon, as far as I understand.
Basically, well, I mean, I understand, like, magazines and crap, but if they're movies and if they're in pristine condition, obviously not the sex toys. Those are, you know, final
sale. Oh, God,
no. Those are final sale. You want my
secondhand swings? Dildo. Like, $12.
I have an entire swing set. you might go, but I mean, like, the boxes of porn, you wouldn't advertise that online, but you could go to a porn store and just ask if it's worth something. So, I mean, I would probably be pissed at the monetary loss, you know, regardless of the collection size. They should have asked him, you know, should have said, come pick it up or we're getting rid of it. So I get that, but publicly suing and not having an issue with talking to the news about it. If I had that, I'd be like, this is my public shame. Never talk about it.
Yeah. I mean, I can't believe that's how much his collection was valued. I mean, I keep an interest in the adult world because I have friends who work in it, and the average DVD is like 30, 40 bucks. I'm guessing a lot of this stuff was probably VHS because that stuff was really expensive back in the day.
Yeah.
So probably, if you're right, if he has
like
stuff that's
a
rare,
real winner, so. Because, you know, somebody lugs that around and somebody lugs that from their old place to their parents' home when they're, how old was he, in his 40s, something like that?
I'm trying to see if his age is mentioned in the story.
He's
40. Yeah, he's 40.
Yeah. So 40, it's probably DVDs.
So, but even still, this is not to kink shame anybody.
No. Just, do your own thing. That's
what, yeah. Do
the
you
the toy boxes? If that's what you want, that's what you want. No problem with that. My issue is when we're in the age of streaming and everything. You know the money he spent on all that. If he really wanted to, he could join like Vivid
any number of
or
sites.
Something. Yeah, he could join a number of sites. Spend like only a couple hundred bucks a year if he truly wanted premium content or very specific things. He could be doing that and have it on the go wherever he wanted and not have to, you know. We're not shaming. He can do what he wants, but maybe, you know, don't alert your parents to your addiction problems.
Yeah, there's a lot of unanswered questions in this, and I have a feeling they should probably best leave unanswered. So that's pretty much going to do it for this edition of The Weird News this week. From iguanas to dead pig brains to porn collections, we've covered it all. So we're going to take a break here on This Week in Geek, and we're going to take another peek into Satan's pantry as we continue our deep dive into Inside Edition's WWE official cookbook. And this week, we're going to take a look at the man we can't see and his fruity cereal bars. We'll be back right after this, and a special review from Alex himself. We'll be back right here on This Week in Geek. I've been Mike the Birdman Dodd, joined with Mr. Christopher and Alex the producer. We'll be back, guys, right after this.
It's a new day. Yes, it is.
Excuse me!
Oh, my God!
Said excuse me!
But WCW's own World Heavyweight Champion Hulk Hogan, he's got Pastamania.
Do you smell what The Rock is cooking?
Give the people what they want.
Welcome back to Satan's Pantry, only on ThisWeekInGeek.net. I am one of your hosts, Mike the Birdman Dodd, and as you've noticed, we have been taking a look at some of the cookbooks from Inside Editions from the worlds of Fallout and the Elder Scrolls, but today we're going to enter the squared circle and take a look at the WWE, the official cookbook from Allison Robicelli. I'm also joined with my tag team partner,
Alex,
who has Kleenex stuck up his nose because...
because it's running and I've been nursing a cold for a while. Leave me alone with my man cold.
It's kind of ridiculous. So in today's edition, as I mentioned last week, we had Nacho Man Randy Savage and gave it an enthusiastic thumbs up. Today we're going to try one of the premier baby faces of WWE, the man you've seen in films like The Marine, Bumblebee, and...
other
Cockblockers.
Other really bad movies that WWE put out in the early 2000s.
No, it wasn't called Cockblockers, it was just called Blockers.
Well, it was called Cockblockers.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, that's not what they marketed it as. No, and what was it, 12 Rounds? Wasn't he in that?
Yeah, at least the first one anyway.
Yeah.
So we are going to try John Cena's Fruity Pebble Treats. And I got to give a special thanks to my in-laws, Dave and Marie, who went over to Buffalo to import the Fruity Pebble cereal because we don't have Fruity Pebbles in Canada for some strange
reason.
They're
only seasonal here, which kind of sucks.
Yeah, so according to John Cena's Fruity Pebbles Treats, there's no way you can't see these Technicolor treats. And that's quite true. They're kind of like a Rice Krispie square with like Fruity Pebbles, basically.
Mixed with, like, Special K.
Yeah, so, without any further ado, let's take a bite of the Fruity Pebbles treats.
Num-num-num.
The Fruity Pebbles really gives it a nice kick in terms of, like, the fruit flavor.
Yeah, it's a little
sweeter different than a Rice Krispie treat.
Yeah, and, I mean, now tasting it, it's good. You could probably substitute this up here with Fruit Loops.
If
you crush them a little bit so they had a similar texture.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, definitely enjoy it. Like, I love cereal treat stuff anyway. It's one of my favorite, like, fat guy treats, I guess.
Well, I mean, they can be a healthy treat to have, too. It's better than eating a chocolate bar or something.
Yeah. I don't know. For some reason, I'm not quite sure what I expected out of John Cena's persona, I guess. Because he has been the spokesperson for Fruity Pebbles for, like, a million years. I'm not quite sure what I expected, though, other than the sound of children outside.
You know what? It tastes like respect.
It does. And and you can't see me. I'm waving my hand in front of the microphone. My wife wants to eat a Fruity Pebble. There you go. Anyway, so I got to say, this is probably yet another winner. This is a fairly simple recipe. It's just importing the cereal. It's going to be a bit of an annoyance.
Or again, switch it out with Fruit Loops
and just crush them up.
Yep.
So anyway, that's going to do it for this edition of Satan's Pantry. Join us next week as we try Ric Flair's Whoopie Pies right here on Satan's Pantry, only on ThisWeekInGeek.net.
Chip, you know what? You just made the list.
Oh, no.
Oh, here we go.
We all can see you. How the hell you think we can miss? You come out here with your bright-ass purple shirt, and before that, your bright green shirt. Before that, your bright orange shirt. You run around here looking like a big fat bowl of Fruity Pebbles.
You can kiss my
ass. Me, Austin!
Oh, son of a bitch.
What?
It's me, Austin! It was me all along, Austin!
My
history with Blaster Master goes back to the NES days when I had the original game and couldn't get very far because I was a dumb kid who wasn't very good, and I ended up having to use a Game Genie to get anywhere in it. And then it sort of fell off the map for me. I didn't play anything else in the series or any remakes or any other iterations of it until I picked up my day one Nintendo Switch, and I needed something pretty much right away to play, and it was one of the first games released on the system, so I picked up the Blaster Master Zero game, and I played the heck out of it, absolutely loved it. You know, it was quite well put together for an early title on the system, and when the second title was announced, Zero Two, just this year, I was like, oh god, that's cool, I can't wait, I'm glad that they're coming out with it. And then I, you know, received an opportunity to get a review copy of it. I jumped on it right away. And what can I say about it? It's the first game and more and better. You know, it is a direct sequel, so you'll want to have played the first game first. You can just jump in if you want to, I guess, but it's a lot better if you played the first game. And the graphics are just, you know, ever so slightly more tweaked and take more advantage of what can be done there. There seems to be a little bit more budget put into the production values of it. Same with the audio, the gameplay, and it's pretty straightforward. It's super duper fun. It's like retro meets modern day. There's not much more I can really say about it. It's just really, really fun, and it's something that I think pretty much anybody's going to want to pick up because, you know, it's reasonably priced. You know, you're looking at, like, when it's on sale and everything, under $20. You know, prices will vary depending on the region you're in and sales and everything, but it's definitely worth picking up, and it's something I've been playing pretty much nonstop. You know, I juggle all the reviews that I have, and this is one of the ones that I go to, you know, for my action, to bring me back to when I was a kid. So that's all I can really say about it. I'm, you know, super duper high on it. I'm going to have to say I'm applauding everybody at Inti Creates on it because it was super awesome. And I can't wait to see what they come up with next.
Hi! I'm Mike. That's Christopher. That's Alex.
Oh, my God. Alex.
And the show's over. Hopefully you've enjoyed this week's edition. Hopefully you've enjoyed this week's edition of This Week in Geek, as we've been all over the place, from pig brains to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and even a guy throwing an iguana at somebody. Poor Copper.
My brain just went Marvel Cinematic pig fuck for some reason.
That may be in the porn collection. We don't know. I bet you that guy's got a copy of the Marvel pornos. Anyway, so for This Week in Geek, we got some stuff coming up this week. As far as I know, we'll have another Turtle Treasure at some point this week. As for things I'm working on, the long-awaited, my review of the Rise of TMNT, which is the new series that's airing on Nickelodeon. I have a DVD which has 90 minutes of episodes. I'll be taking a look at that. I have Assassin's Creed 3 Remastered, which features one of my favorite protagonists from the series, that being Connor Kenway, mostly because he's native, and I just think his Assassin's Creed costume looks cool. Also, I will be taking a look at the SNK Arcade Collection, which was recently released on the PlayStation 4. Alex will have a review of Days Gone for next week, I believe.
Good God, am I terrified of that game, but it's super fun.
That's
not a review. That's not a review. I'll give the full review later, because I believe it's one of those cases where they
don't want full impression.
Yeah, that's an impression. They don't want full reviews out till, I believe, Friday. But as my impression is, I'm terrified.
And that's good. I'm really glad Sony was able to capture that with that game, because what they accomplished with The Last of Us, which recently just finished shooting its final scene, so I'm really looking forward to seeing what happens with that. I'm going to be purchasing Mortal Kombat 11. I'm going to be doing that probably today or tomorrow, so you should have a review in about a week or so, because I love the Mortal Kombat franchise. So what are we looking forward from you, Mr. Trister? What do you have on the review docket right now?
I'm actually pretty much clear, which is, you know, kind
of
boring.
Son of a bitch.
So I'm probably going to look around to see if there's anything I can pick up for cheap on Steam or another store and see if I can just grab something.
Did we end up putting out the Book of Unwritten Tales?
I have it ready and submitted, so I don't know if I'm actually published
it yet. That'll come on on one of our shows.
So look forward to that.
And, I mean, we've also got, next time we meet up, we're probably going to do another commentary or two, so We've got some medieval stuff in the works there that looked ridiculous.
Hopefully
you've gone back and watched with us our
Chopping Mall.
If not, check it out. It's on Tubi. It's completely free. You might have an ad that pops up when you first start watching it. If you have an ad blocker, you won't. That was super duper fun to do. So we were hoping to do more of those. At least a couple a month is the idea. And I think as a preview over the summer, as things get super duper hot, we might do more and more of those to, you know, have fill out the time when we have like the crazy heat waves.
Yeah, exactly. Because during the summer, we may take a week off each month. In fact, there's probably going to be a twig holiday break because we deserve it. But don't worry, the content will still be coming out. We're going to bank some content over the next few weeks before, like Alex said, the crazy heat gets here. But we'll be a part of your summer vacation no matter what. One of the things I'm going to propose to the boys, and I got to wait till Tristan sees it, is we'll do an Avengers Endgame discussion once everybody here on the crew has seen it. We'll talk about the larger cinematic universe, our thoughts on it and whatnot. I should be back on Altered Geek and Future Imperfect, as I think Star Trek Discovery has wrapped up its second season.
It's fantastic, and you got to watch it. And then you still got to watch the fucking Orville.
Well, I guess I'm going to have some time coming up.
Contact Mike and make fun of him for not watching the Orville. Make fun of him and troll him hard.
Well, first I'm going to finish Persona, then I'm going to finish Game of Thrones.
Correct. All right. You got good things to watch and do anyway.
I'm looking forward to it. So anyway, guys, until next week, we have been
Mr. Christopher.
Alex.
I've been Mike the Birdman Dodd saying be cool, be kind, be careful, and as always, live for your Die Hard.
Well, that's our show. All right, here's the deal. Every time you watch my show, I will send you $40.
Checks will not be honored.
You've been listening to This Week in Geek, your source for guaranteed nonsense or your money back. Tune in next week for more info and the most important things you didn't need to know. Check out our website at thisweekingeek.net and subscribe to our podcast through iTunes or any podcatcher. If you'd like to comment on this episode, head over to this episode's post at thisweekingeek.net and leave a comment through Facebook Connect. Follow us on Twitter at thisweekingeek.net and follow our Instagram at twig_official_podcast. Social media not your thing? Send us an email at feedback@thisweekingeek.net. We'll see you next time, and remember,
lower your shields and surrender your listenership.
Just when you think this show is terrible, something wonderful happens.
What?
It ends.
I have to go. Somewhere there is a crime happening.